supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. The play The Outgoing Tide is having a run at the Philadelphia Theater Company. The story's about an aging man's coming to terms with his cognitive decline due to Alzheimer's and an emotionally vulnerable family's attempt to do what's best for everyone. It's a drama that unfortunately feels familiar to many families. In fact, the National Institute on Aging suggests that as many as 5.1 million Americans may now have Alzheimer's disease. And if you think about that, the number of people affected by that disease, that number quadruples at the very least. As of today, Alzheimer's is an irreversible, progressive brain illness that slowly destroys memory and thinking skills and eventually the ability to do even small tasks. Families coping with the illness face many new responsibilities and must ride an emotional roller coaster that can be disorienting at best. On today's show, we're going to be talking about Alzheimer's and its emotional impact on families with two guests, Felicia Greenfield and Bruce Graham. Felicia Greenfield's a clinical social worker. She's the Associate Director for Clinical and Research Operations at the Penn Memory Center. She joins us here in the studio. Felicia, hello. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Bruce Graham is an award-winning playwright, teacher, and actor. He's written The Outgoing Tide. Bruce, welcome.
Thank you.
And congratulations, by the way. It's had rave reviews and a strong opening week.
We'll see. Well, actually, we open Wednesday night.
Wednesday night.
The previews have been going well.
Yeah.
The ones I've been there for. I don't show up all the time.
And our number, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If you've had experience, past or present, with a loved one with Alzheimer's, please give us a call. Felicia, are you with couples when they first get the diagnosis, when they first hear that word?
Sometimes I'm there with the couple when they first get the diagnosis.
What's it like? What happens to them?
Some families suspect that there's a problem and they come in knowing what it might be. Some don't, and it's a surprise to them. We, at the Penn Memory Center, we have what's called a diagnostic follow-up visit. So the patient comes in with their family for an initial visit. They do some psychometric testing and a clinical evaluation. They go and have some brain imaging, and then they come back a few weeks later, and the doctor has the opportunity to go over the results of the imaging and their testing. And then there's a social worker or health educator in the room with the family. And
someone akin to yourself.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then the doctor leaves, and the family has some time to sit with the social worker or health educator and process what they just learned and are provided with resources that they can take advantage of.
Tell me about that moment when the door closes, what it's like for them. I'm even interested in what it's like for you, Felicia.
You're reading the family the whole time the doctor is telling them, you know, what's going on and adjusting accordingly. More times than not, the family is aware that that's why they're coming to the Penn Memory Center. But it is hard because what they're hearing is that it's a progressive, irreversible disease for which there is no treatment.
What's the emotions? What do you hear in the room after the doctor leaves?
there are tears. There's anger. I mean, it runs the gamut.
And the person with Alzheimer's, what's that reaction?
Sometimes it's denial. Sometimes there is, I mean, it's different every single time. Some people come in with more insight than others. No two diagnostic follow-up visits are the same.
Mm-hmm. What's it like for you to be in that room when they hear it for the first time?
It's, I mean, it's emotional because you know what they're in for, I am with them, and I ask the family how much they want right now. And depending on who they are, you can get into the whole stages in resources. It's hard for me.
Yeah. You're vastly underpaid. I have no idea what you make, but you should get more. I don't know how people do that.
I agree with you. I agree. The stage of life that this happens at is often when people are looking to retire or have just mm-hmm. retired. I mean, mm-hmm. plans. They've got mm-hmm. all sorts of mm-hmm. plans. There must be mm-hmm. such anger at, you know, it's a betrayal.
Certainly.
This diagnosis is a betrayal.
It is. I facilitate an early stage support group for people with a new diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease and their family members. Usually it's their spouses. And that's exactly what we hear. You know, the spouses are saying, this isn't what I planned on. I planned on retiring and traveling, and now I have to do Alzheimer's.
The one piece of data that I keep reading when I read articles about Alzheimer's over and over is about early detection. And we know that that's a key to the treatment before the brain is ravaged by the illness. Our producer, Jennifer Lynn, brought this up with neurologist Doug Shari. He's director of the Division of Cognitive Neurology at Ohio State University in Columbus. Let's listen.
You're involved in an outreach project this week in a predominantly African-American community near your clinic. Now, you told me earlier that you suspect many of the people you'll be meeting tend to delay diagnosis and sometimes underutilize services for those with cognitive impairment. Why?
The thing that you mentioned, we go out and do community memory or cognitive screening. The people that have early Alzheimer's typically have this impaired insight. They don't see the problem as much as everyone else. And so when they go into the doctor, it's just a minor problem, you know, and the whole family's going, oh, my gosh, mom's changed so much, you know, or dad's really declined. And yet they don't want to go into the doctor's office with them because, you know, they've never done that before, you know. So there's this hesitation, there's this delay. And what we found is that instead of waiting and wasting and having the brain be more damaged, sometimes we just go out to the community. And we do some cognitive screens, and we can have the discussion early to say, hey, you know, a little bit of problems with your cognitive tests. I don't know what it's from, but maybe you should go see your doctor. Talk to your doctor about it. They can investigate. Maybe it's something easily treatable, because there are very treatable causes of memory loss. And even if it is something like Alzheimer's disease, the treatments we have now work fantastically if you get them early. I devised a self-administered cognitive tool so that it doesn't, for example, it can be given as a screening in the doctor's office, which is probably the best place for it, but it doesn't take the doctor's time or the nurse's time or the aide's time. The person just does this test on themselves. It's just 4 pages, just pen and paper. You read it, you write down your answers, and you turn it in, and the doctor can then grade it.
Can you think of a sample question that's in this survey?
Yeah, so we show them some pictures, and they have to name the pictures, but spelling doesn't count, so they can spell however they want as long as it's somewhat interpretable. We have them do some math questions. We have them do some drawings. They're supposed to copy like a cube or some three-dimensional letter holder that they see there. They just make a copy of it. There's a test to draw a clock and put the hands at a certain time. We may ask them to write down a number of different animals that they can think of. There's some visual spatial type tasks and problem-solving tasks and a memory task. They're not necessarily meant to do perfect scores because we want to get people that are very early on, but we can pick out generally very easily people that may be beginning to have trouble, and it can be followed over time so that maybe they get a certain score, maybe that's them, you know, and that's where they always are. But if there's a change over time, then that would be perhaps a significant thing, that this test then can be, you know, repeated several times over time to identify if there is any changes in their thinking.
Well, good luck to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Doug Shari. He's director of the Division of Cognitive Neurology at Ohio State University in Columbus. Listen, to download the cognitive screening that he was referring to, go to SAGE test. That's SAGETEST.OSU.EDU. And we'll try to get that link on our webpage also. The thing that struck me, Felicia, is that he was talking about all sorts of interventions. He sounded pretty optimistic about possibilities for people who get an early diagnosis.
There are things people can do to delay progression, and those things include physical exercise, social stimulation, proper nutrition, and with the proper kind of cognitive training programs, people can delay. So it is a good idea.
I want to switch gears a little bit here and talk about what the theme of the show is here, and that's impact on families. And I wonder what some of the factors are that come into play. And I'm just going to throw them all out and pick up whatever you want. Race, gender, socioeconomics, culture, and even their emotional resources, education, things like that. Do any of those things, all of those things, come into play with how one copes with the diagnosis and the progression?
Mm-hmm.
I just promised her this would be an easy show. And I wouldn't ask her hard questions, but she can't get out now.
I'm glad you're asking her these.
Yeah.
The people that we tend to see at the Penn Memory Center tend to be educated, white, middle-class families. We do have a minority outreach component, but there are different, you're talking about race and culture, and those are important aspects to study in terms of caring for the families. We see a lot of Latino patients who come in, and they tend to care for their loved ones in their home, and don't necessarily reach out for as many of the resources that we have.
What are those resources? What's available for families, for loved ones?
Well, we do have... for Latino families or all families? Okay. Well, through the Alzheimer's Association and through the Penn Memory Center, we offer various supports. There are support groups for individuals with dementia, as well as their spouses or caregivers, individual psychotherapy, group psychotherapy, psychoeducational groups for caregivers. Most of these things are available through the Alzheimer's Association or Penn Memory Center for free to relatively inexpensive.
How about things like respite, care at home, how to find those resources, how and when it's okay to go away for a weekend and care for yourself.
Mm-hmm. We have staff who is able to work with families on making those decisions and also making referrals to respite resources in the community.
Hmm. We're talking about the impact of an Alzheimer's diagnosis on the family. We're talking now with Felicia Greenfield. She's a clinical social worker at Penn and works with these patients and families We're going to be talking in just a couple minutes with Bruce Graham, who wrote The Outgoing Tide. He's an award-winning playwright, and it's about a family coping with the cognitive decline of a family member. We had a caller, Felicia, that wanted to know the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's, and I want to nuance that question a bit, not the physiology of that, but the psychology, the impact on families. Is there a difference?
There may be. Dementia is a broad term, and Alzheimer's disease is one form of dementia. I think people are probably less so now, but still afraid of the word Alzheimer's disease. I think dementia sounds less scary.
Less shameful.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what happens, what it means to be a caregiver, a family member of one with dementia or Alzheimer's, it means the same. It's kind of the same roller coaster. It's the loss
sure.
of mm-hmm. someone while they're still there.
Yes.
And dealing with all of those emotions.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, Bruce, I want to talk to you and The Outgoing Tide. I want to introduce our listeners to the to that show and let them hear a bit about what it sounds like. We're talking about the impact of Alzheimer's on the family. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're with Felicia Greenfield and Bruce Graham, and we'll be back in a very short 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Walk MS supports WHYY. Research shows that one out of two local residents know someone living with multiple sclerosis. That someone, your sister, coworker, or even that neighbor who insists on cheering for the Yankees, needs your help. Walk MS is changing the lives of the thousands of local someones affected by MS. More at 800-883-WALK or walkformS.org. That's walkformS.org for the Walk MS coming this spring in a community near you.
Tonight, it's special coverage from NPR News. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature health care law. It's one of the most important legal and policy cases of our generation. I'm Jennifer Ludden. Join me for a recap of today's arguments. That's special coverage from NPR News. The Supreme Court debates health care.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about the impact of a diagnosis of Alzheimer's on the family. We're with Felicia Greenfield. She's a social worker, associate director for clinical and research operations at the Penn Memory Center. Bruce Graham's with us. He's an award-winning playwright and teacher and actor. His play is called The Outgoing Tide. It addresses a family's in distress over this diagnosis. Bruce, The Outgoing Tide's about a powerhouse of a man who is developing Alzheimer's. How come? Why this topic?
Well, actually, it's kind of an end-of-life issue, and it could be anything. It could be cancer. It could be, you know, any sort of debilitating death sentence. The word Alzheimer's is never used in the play. Some students pointed that out the other, and they asked me why, and I said, because it's really hard to spell, for one thing. But I didn't really want this, you know, to – yes, is it a part of the play? Certainly. To me, the play is about, you know, regret and forgiveness, and you get to the end of your life, and you say, gee, I made some mistakes. Wouldn't it be great if I could go back, you know, with my family or my friends or whatever? And he makes some reference to a mulligan in the play, you know, a do-over. You don't get that in life. And you get to the end of your life sometime. Well, I'm not there yet, but I'm 55, and I do think about this stuff. And you look back and say, wow, I wish I'd done that differently. And what he's trying to do is make things right before the inevitable. And I think in Truth in Advertising, it sounds really depressing, but it's not, I don't think. It's a lot of comedy in it, because otherwise, what's the point? The characters have to make you laugh, or you don't care about them. Or no one wants to sit there and get beat over the head with a disease. So there's other plot threads going on, and there is a lot of comedy.
You remind me of a quote I read over the weekend, and I can't attribute it to anyone, but the quote was, "The reason we are placed in this material world is to always gather material."
Find out who said that. I can use it in my class.
I want to listen to a clip from the first scene of that play. In this scene, the lights come up to reveal a beachside house and its retired owner, Gunnar, who is fishing and chatting with a younger man who's just arrived in town. The two seem to be strangers. Gunnar is affable and quick-witted, but the younger man seems uncomfortable. In this clip, we find out why. In fact, the other man is Gunnar's son, Jack, whom he has failed to recognize.
See, we always lived in Philly. I had a business, nothing big, 22 trucks. I sold that and moved down here. My son lives out in the suburbs, and my friends, all old guys, sit at McDonald's every morning for 3 hours drinking coffee and talking about their doctor's appointments. Why are you getting divorced?
Well, you know a lot of things. I guess, who knows?
Which house is yours?
This one. That's Jack Gunn. You are talking to Jack.
Bruce, what do we know about this man before his diagnosis?
He's a tough guy. All three characters are not kind of poor, pitiful me. I can't stand characters like that. I don't think the audience does. They're fighting it. And this is a guy who's been in charge his whole life. He's not an educated man, but he's a smart man, and he's tough. And to realize he's losing his faculties, he's not going to be able to recognize his wife and son, that is horrendous to him. And he's going to deal with it in his own way. Gunnar has never walked to anybody else's drum but his own. And that's the crux of the play.
Felicia, I would imagine, well, I know personally, this sets up great conflict in the family, depending on how the person with the dementia deal with it. I remember my mother had dementia, and I remember one of the most painful days for me was when we had to take her car keys away, and it was even more painful for my father. They had been married 60 years, and he really felt like he was betraying her, and she took all her anger out on him because he was safe. He was safe. How do families cope with all that guilt and grief and anger?
It's really hard. Driving is maybe one of the most difficult challenges to get used to with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. They need to harness their resources and find people in the community or in their families to help them with these transitions. And there is a lot of anger and a lot of grief.
How do they even know what they need? You know, almost everybody I speak to who's going through a crisis, if they have a network, no matter what size, people always say to them, "What can I do for you?" And the response is, "I don't even know what I need." And I've got my own shame about asking, but I don't even know what I need. Mm-hmm. Is that part of your job, is to help them know what they need?
It is. It is. There's an element of support and counseling and education that goes along with our job as facilitators and social workers. And frankly, part of the physician's job as well to assess whether someone should be driving or not. Many people continue to drive into the progression of the disease.
I was behind one the other day. I'd be curious to know if there's a difference in a male's reaction and a female's reaction. Whether, you know, because, you know, the male is, oh my God, you know, that's the car, that's mm-hmm. the extension, that's mm-hmm. everything, you know. And just little things that they don't want to be dependent. Is there more resistance, do you find?
I think the reaction is the same. It's a loss of freedom.
Mm-hmm. These guys are bigger idiots about it, that's all.
And also, you know, your gunner was a trucker, mm-hmm. and I do work with a former truck driver and a former SEPTA driver.
Oh, wow.
And it's a real struggle mm-hmm. for them.
Sure.
We're talking with Felicia Greenfield and Bruce Graham about the emotional impact of this diagnosis of Alzheimer's on the family. Our numbers 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. We've got Kelly on the line. Kathy, I'm sorry. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Good afternoon, everybody.
Hi. Hello.
I just wanted to advise people. I took care of my mother for about 4 years and worked full time. She had Alzheimer's. It was unbearable for me. Unfortunately, back then, I did not know what the resources were out there. And also, I had brothers and sisters, but they were all married, and everything fell on my shoulders because I was the single one. It's just, I think it's really important that people, if they're in this situation, really try to get help. My mother passed away. I still have guilt and anger at the family because it's like nobody ever helped me, you know. And even when you say to people, I need help, they were never there, you know. So it's really important for the caregiver to think of themselves also and to step back. And had I known then what resources I know now, it would have been a totally different situation.
How did you find out?
How did we find out she had Alzheimer's?
No, I'm sorry. How did you find out the resources?
Well, after my mother died, I should say first they put her in a nursing home, and then she passed away after that. I did try going on the Alzheimer's internet. But, you know, when you're so busy taking care mm-hmm. of the patient, you don't have time for yourself. You know, I would come home from work and literally take care of her and then go up and go to work and come back. So, you know, you don't have that kind of time that you really would devote to it if you knew beforehand. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So one of the things you need is a researcher.
Right.
You know, someone, you know, ideally a social worker, but that's the kind of thing a good friend could do. You know, just turn to a friend and say.
And the family should do it also.
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah.
know, but, you know, the family sometimes mm-hmm. just looks away.
Well, I don't want to get specifics about
your
family here, but I do. And Kathy, thanks for your call and what you bring
Thank
up.
You.
We're gonna follow up. That story, Kathy's story about a family turning their back, or even friends turning their back, is not unusual. Why is that?
Usually, when it's a parent who has Alzheimer's disease, usually one of the siblings will step up and take on the majority of the work. And often they feel as though their siblings are not being as helpful. So we do work with people on how to ask for help.
Hmm. And do you work with people about how to give help, how to offer help?
We should work on that more.
Yeah. I want to read a comment from Facebook. Burke writes, "For the patient friend, I have learned not to finish his sentences or ask for elaborations when he makes observations." And then he goes on to talk about this person's wife and teenage son, that he learned the value of listening to them. And he said it was not difficult to go that extra mile. So I think friends and extended family members need to be educated mm-hmm. about what they can do mm-hmm. and what would be helpful. I think we're hardwired to be helpful. in this case. But, you know, if there's anxiety or shame attached to it, you know, we can turn that light off pretty quickly.
What Kathy just said, though, is actually kind of the crux of why every playwright starts with his or her family. If you look at the history of especially American plays, we all, I know I certainly did, and Robert Anderson and Tennessee Williams and everybody, because there's always some sort of conflict, and you know the characters really well. And, I mean, Kathy was unfortunately saying it's the crux of a play right there, you know, that one person is usually stuck with it.
So you just set yourself up here with that comment. So tell me about your family that you were writing about.
Actually, I had to, in my first play, Berkey, I had a similar situation almost, only it was different. But in it, I have a brother and sister, and the brother is stuck with the father, and the sister isn't because she lives 1,000 miles away. And my sister and I get along great. She's 800 miles away, but boy, if I needed her, she was on the next plane, and when dealing with my mother's death and everything. And so when we were in the car going up to New York to see it off Broadway, my father said, boy, where do you see this play? You're a real witch in this thing. Only that's not the word he said. We're on the radio. And I said, people who get along make for lousy drama. So I had to make, you know, the sister and the brother at loggerheads there. In my own experience, I've been lucky. Yeah.
How so?
I mean, the fact that I don't have Kathy's problem. You know, although my sister was away distance-wise, she was always offering to help and then backing it up. You know, yeah, was I there? Yeah, I had to do a little more day-to-day stuff. But there were times that I'd say, hey, come on up for a couple of weeks, and she'd come up for a couple of weeks. And it was any time I need her. So it was none of that resentment there, which I've seen other families go through.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Tom on the line.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Great program this morning. I wanted to, first of all, explain that I had been able to find good resources online out there for my grandmother. I moved in with her over two years ago, and she has since passed away, but she had moderate to, I would say, severe dementia, Alzheimer's. And one of the things I was hoping that you could, your guest or yourself could discuss or kind of addresses the, it's been 6 months now, and it's almost like a postpartum or post-depressive state that I'm in, that since she, it was very frustrating. I had a lot of great family support, but I lived with her, and it was every day there were things, there was a consciousness, there was a taking care of and making sure she doesn't do anything to harm herself. And now that she's gone, I notice that there's quite a bit of residual stuff of just.
Tom, name it when you say you say stuff.
I felt, yeah, okay. As an example, I felt to this day I still feel very angry with myself that I was angry with her, like she would go against the better judgment for herself, and she would do stuff like take walks without letting anybody know that, and then get lost type of stuff. So and I would be kind of ticked off and angry with her, and then never really process that, where now it's more like I feel sad that I was that way, where I'd be angry with her, like, how dare you put yourself when she really didn't know. So there were a lot of examples of that where I was angry and upset, and she had changed so much since I had known her so quickly prior, because she was very independent.
You were angry at this woman who was ill because she was harming that grandmother that you loved so much. And you couldn't stop her.
No, there was really no way to revisit how she used to be, because it was what it was. So, and there's oftentimes I'm very upset with myself, and I know you can't go back and do it again, but I just wondered if there were, I guess it's time. I don't know if time heals that.
Time is a large part of it. You know, regret is the persistence of the impossible.
Right, right.
And it's tough to let go of. Felicia, what? Any thoughts?
I hear it all the time. People are angry with the way they're treating the person that they're caring for. Bruce had it in his play with the pancakes.
As a matter of fact, let me interrupt that. I went because there's a piece that I want to play. It might not be the exact one, but this is a conversation Gunner's son Jack had with his mother Peg about Gunner's decline and how difficult it is becoming for her to care for him. She recalls a typical confrontation between her and Gunner, which is reenacted for the audience.
The TV's broken.
No, it's not.
I was trying to what? Stop that. Hate that.
What?
The big sigh. The crazy old man's driving me nuts. Sigh.
The TV is fine.
All right, I'm going to go slowly here. It is plugged in. This is the right clicker. It's not the clicker for the other things. It's the TV clicker. I replaced the batteries in the clicker. And I know they're good because they were in the package. You following me here? The batteries are in the right location, the right position. I know. I double-checked. I point the clicker at the television. I push power, and nothing happens. Therefore, Peg, the goddamn TV is broken.
Gunner, that's the microwave.
That's, so very painful, and we hear the seething anger underneath it on both parts. How difficult is it, Bruce, for someone to withhold all that anger and frustration? Where did you get this information?
I steal from life. Dan, I've never written an original thing in my life. And what Tom was just saying on the phone here is right out of the play. Peg is told by a counselor not to feel guilty. And she says, what should I feel guilty about? I'm trying to do the right thing. But she does feel guilty. My father was alive when this play was done in Chicago last year. And I rewrote a couple things. He passed away in December. And one of the things is that Peg would get angry because Gunner asked for pancakes 20 times a day. She goes, pancakes, I know, you told me. And I just want to yell at him. And in the first version, she didn't. In the second version, I have her say, I finally snapped the other day. I said, 20 stinking times, I know about the stupid pancakes. And I felt awful, the look on his face. Why? Because I would do that. And I would go home, and my wife, I said, I just yelled at Dad. You know, I'm not the most patient person in the world. Neither was he. We butted heads even when everything was fine. So what Tom is feeling is quite natural. It's in the play, and it shows that he's a very empathetic and loving person. But eventually you just say that, you know, that's human nature. We lose our temper. That's what the play is about, wanting to go back. And he just said it. He wishes he could go back, but he knows he can't. And that's really what we all feel. So what Tom is feeling is sadly very universal.
The the persistence of the impossible. We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we've got lots of callers, and I want to read a very poignant poem written by a daughter to her mother, about her mother, who was dying of Alzheimer's. That's what we're talking about. The impact of Alzheimer's on the family. We're with Felicia Greenfield, Clinical Social Worker Associate Director for Clinical and Research Operations at the Penn Memory Center. That must be a pretty large business card you have.
It's a long title.
Bruce Graham is an award-winning playwright, teacher, and actor. His play is called The Outgoing Tide, and it's at the Philadelphia Theater Company.
And I don't have a business card.
Don't have a business card. A typical actor. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Please Touch Museum supports WHYY and welcomes Word Girl from PBS on Thursday, March 29th at 11 a.m. at the museum. It's an opportunity for families to meet this favorite TV character and take pictures together. Please Touch Museum is located just off Interstate 76 with plenty of on-site parking. Word Girl, Thursday, March 29th at 11 a.m. More information online at pleasetouchmuseum.org.
What happens when the powerful forces of war, race, and music collide? Novelist Essie Adugin takes a trip to the 1930s to find out in her book, Half-Blood Blues.
I was very interested in this, the era of the Third Reich. You know, these were stories I really hadn't heard before, and it grew out of that.
The story of black jazz musicians in wartime Europe is at the center of this new novel. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the impact of Alzheimer's on the family with social worker Felicia Greenfield, playwright Bruce Graham. As I promised before the break, I want to read a poem. It was written by poet Joan Kaczmarski as her mother was dying of Alzheimer's. It's called Emptied. A year has gone. An eternity passed. Our lives, as we once knew them, have ceased. In your face, I see the confusion in your eyes. All that we once were, all that we once shared, is gone, emptied. At times, I feel you grope in your darkness, searching for that light of connection, a faint glimmer, a brief second of recognition. And then, as the impulse courses through the circuitry of your awareness, it shorts, then dies, as I desperately try to hold it near. If you had died, I could somehow place all of these emotions inside a prayer, raise my eyes to the heavens, and remain connected to you, your energy, soul, your being. But you're not dead, not gone, just emptied, a shell, hardened, isolated, disconnected from everyone you once showered so selflessly with your love. I'm left withering, convulsing, cut off from my lifeline. But for you, it's all meaningless. Even the tears that fall down my face confuse you. That's heartbreaking. And I should say that this wonderful poet, Joan Kaczmarski, is also a very dear friend of mine. But she's quite a talented poet. Does this kind of capture the emotion, Felicia?
Yeah, I would say it does.
The last line especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the tears that confuse you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's how do you grieve when a person's sitting there right in front of you? And you know, one of the things I hear is that, you know, this unresolved mourning, and what I hear from caregivers is, I have to run around pulling together all these resources, keeping them safe, knowing when to go and when not to go. Who has time to sit down and cry? And yet, all buried emotions are buried alive. They roost in there. What kind of care do caregivers really need?
I think, what Kathy was saying earlier is acknowledgement of the fact that you are the caregiver and that I need help. And it's very tough, what we said earlier, to ask for it. And it's even tougher when you ask for it and don't get it. I mean, how do you go back again and ask for it if you've been turned down once? You supposedly, there's nothing more complicated than a family relationship. You know, there's all sorts of, you know, skeletons and resentments and all that sort of stuff going on, and they just come to the surface in a situation like this.
We work with caregivers to learn how to take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of resistance. How can I take care of myself? I don't even know how to take care of myself. But little by little, we try to teach them how to continue to do things that they enjoy, continue to see friends, and just make the time to take care of themselves, because they are suffering from higher rates of depression and anxiety.
Well, so am I right now on this show. Anybody know any jokes? This is really kind of like something. I need a drink.
Hey, thanks a lot. You know, we've got a good reputation, and here you go.
It's not the first place I've ruined a reputation.
Really, Jennifer, no more for this guy, okay? No more on the show. playwrights. I like social workers better. They're easier to deal with. They're more predictable. All right, let's go back to the lines. We've got Kathy on the line. Kathy, hi. You're on
voice. Hi. I just wanted to say I've taken care of Mom and Dad for years, and Mom's 10 years into her diagnosis. Dad has passed on. And the thing that it taught me was just to be patient and to go slower. It's more Buddhist. I'm more Buddhist than Catholic now at times, I must say. And it's after having a job that was very manic for 36 years, this has been a great learning experience for me.
How are you?
I'm doing okay. The poem was hit home pretty good, I'll tell you that. I miss my mom sometimes. She's here, but she's not here all the time. So she's here, and I still miss her.
That's a very good description.
I think many of us who have lost parents feel exactly the same way. Kathy, thanks so much for your call. I'm struck, Felicia, by this theme of guilt I hear. And I hear it from parents with children who have autism and for children who were taking care of parents with Alzheimer's. I heard it from my father, who did a lion's share of the work for my mother, and he was 83 years old, this guilt. And these are all people who were doing way more than their bodies, spirits can tolerate. And they're doing all that and more, and still they feel guilt. What can be done?
They just need to talk to people. They need to find other people, I think, who are going through similar experiences. I think that in addition to guilt, there's a great sense of loneliness, and that they're the only people going through this. They don't know anyone else who's going through this. So it's important for them to join support groups and find other people who are going through similar experiences. And I think that if they hear what other people are going through, that they can help with their guilt. Also to talk to a therapist, just work on it.
Well, I am also of the belief that guilt is a way of protecting us from our own helplessness. And that's an emotion most people don't tolerate very well. But to sit there and say, you are suffering and there's nothing I can do to diminish your suffering, that's anguish, that's agony. But if we tell ourselves, there's something I can do and I'm just not doing it, you know, that's the cure for that helplessness, right? We've worked up this grand delusion that we can and should be doing something more, rather than, as we learned from Kathy, to sit with the truth that there's not much we can do.
Well, she said something very smart, I think. In the fact, she said she's more Buddhist than Catholic in learning patience now, and having to sit back and inevitable, you know. And guilt is, you know, it's a natural part of the process, but it's also damaging to you. And, at a time when you need all your energy and concentration, it's zapping it.
Well, one thing I'm sure Kathy has learned, that sometimes when the heart breaks, it opens. And that changes everything. Let's go back to the lines. We've got Loida on the line. Loida, I hope I didn't get your name too wrong.
No, that's right.
Good. What can we do for you?
Oh, my father, he's had dementia for about 10 years now. And we go to the family doctor. He's never had any kind of testing or anything done. His memory is getting worse and worse, and he's very verbally abusive to my mother, who's his primary caregiver. And we're kind of at a loss. We keep asking the doctor, what should we do? And he's like, well, I don't know. When you can't take it anymore, we'll have to do something. We're just kind of lost.
I'm glad you called. What are the resources available for Lloyd and Felicia?
That's a tough one. Your father is verbally abusive to your mother. Is that what I'm hearing? Verbally abusive.
Every county has an aging authority. I think Philadelphia is Philadelphia Council for Aging. You can call them if you're in Philadelphia, whatever county you're in, and they will send social service out to your home and evaluate the situation. They'll tell you about what resources are available in the community, but your mother should not be in harm's way. If your father needs more intervention, and it sounds like he does, PCA or whatever aging authority in your community will help you get there. Boy, I'm glad you called. Thank you. Felicia, what's this work like for you?
I find it to be a pleasure to work with families who are dealing with this issue of memory loss, because even though it's sad and overwhelming, there is some joy in there too, and having the privilege to work with the families on dealing with the difficult things, but then also helping them to find ways to make it tolerable and even enjoyable is a privilege. I also come home to my own life differently, taking less for granted on a daily basis, and it allows you to see that nothing is permanent, and you deal with changes as they come along in life. And
do you worry about your mind, your memory?
Of course.
As you age?
Yeah. I mean, this is what we do all day long. Yeah. So, yeah, there is worry.
As I think about it, that was kind of a stupid question because I don't know who doesn't. That's pretty universal. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. My guests have been social worker Felicia Greenfield and playwright Bruce Graham. And listeners can keep the conversation going on WHYY's Facebook page. Please log in. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about how budget cuts are impacting autism support services. And we'll hear from the author of The Art of Autism, where you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com, and our production team is at voices@whyy.org. To download today's show or listen to past shows, we're at whyy.org/voices. Well, the engineer for today's show's been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Mark Cernero is our intern. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.